You've probably heard the term ESG investing. Environmental, social, and corporate governance, or ESG, refers to three central factors in measuring the sustainability and ethical impact of an investment in a company or business. ESG has caught the attention of individual and fund investors, pension and hedge fund managers, sell-side analysts, banks, other lenders, and political interest groups and activists. But how's ESG being received in corporate boardrooms, and what are the risks involved? We have Jones Day's Linda Hess and David Woodcock here to talk about it. I'm Dave Dalton. You're listening to Jones Day Talks. Based in our Paris office, Jones Day's Linda Hess advises clients in the areas of capital markets, securities law, public M&A, and corporate governance under both U.S. and French law. She acts for issuers with respect to their issuances of debt and equity securities, listings on Euronext, NASDAQ, and the New York Stock Exchange, and on regulatory matters involving the SEC and the French AMF. Working primarily out of Jones Day offices in Dallas and Washington, David Woodcock represents companies, boards, and individuals in government investigations, internal investigations, shareholder litigation, and compliance counseling. He was formerly director of the SEC's Fort Worth regional office and chair of the SEC's Financial Reporting and Audit Task Force. Linda, David, thanks for being here today.
Hi, David. Nice to be here.
Hey, yeah, thank you. Thank you for having us.
All right, let's jump right into this. Linda, let's go a little bit 101-ish just to make sure everybody understands. Let's get our definition down right. Can you tell us exactly what is ESG?
Well, that's a really good question, David. Given that there's been this alphabet soup of terms that have been swirling around, questions of sustainability and ESG investing. ESG very simply stands for environmental, social, and governance. And these three things are really considered the main factors that have been identified as ways to measure whether or not a particular company, investment, or even a country is sustainable, responsible, and ethical. The measures have been developed or are actually still in the process of being developed because there's a need to look beyond purely financial measures to decide whether or not to invest in a particular activity, to look to whether the entity can be seen as being sustainable over the long term.
Where did this movement, Linda, if that's the right term, where did this start? Was this an EU phenomenon or is it in the United States? Or where would you say the roots are in ESG?
I think it's really very much global. There was the UN initiative on sustainability, which has been a kickstart to this, followed, of course, by and probably the accelerator is the Paris Climate Accord. And the EU, of course, is picking up on that very strongly.
Okay, so ESG has become part of the vernacular of our times, I guess. But let's go to David for a second. They say, all right, everyone's talking about ESG. Well, who is everyone, David? Who's talking about ESG right now and who's concerned with it?
Well, you know, I think there are a large number of different constituencies that are concerned about this. I would go back to something Linda said earlier. One of the other things that's happening here is the groups pushing ESG disclosures are pushing it in part to get companies away from short-term thinking and away from the focus just on quarterly profits. So it's really meant to sort of get companies and the boards to think more long-term. And that's true with respect to investors as well. They're really trying to get them to think about the long-term success of the company and away from the sort of short-term thinking, which is really a positive aspect
here. Sure.
In terms of who's talking about it, like I said, a lot of people, most importantly to certainly companies and lenders and banks, are investors. Investors are very, very interested in ESG disclosures right now. And that means pension funds, hedge funds, sell-side analysts, large money managers, institutional managers. There's a lot of money that's being invested every year, and that money is very interested in how companies are doing with respect to their ESG. And that's kind of turned back on them now, and the investors and pension funds and others are interested in how the banks and the lenders are considering ESG risks. So lenders and banks are now really pushing this issue with respect to those who are trying to use their services. You hear that term green finance. That's a lot of what this is talking about. Academics are also really interested in this. Political interest groups, you couldn't have this conversation without discussing the sort of interest by political interest groups in ESG. And then finally, I would say, is corporations and boards are really talking about this and thinking about this a lot right now. Part of that is because of the pressure that they are getting from their own shareholders through shareholder proposals and that sort of thing, and shareholder inquiries. But corporations and boards are really on top of this right now as well.
Okay, I'm glad you brought that up. And you talked about long-term investing and thinking beyond the next quarter. I think that's all great. But let me play contrarian for a second, or devil's advocate. Conventionally, you know, capitalism, you talk about, you know, what's the role of the board? What's the role of company management? Maximize shareholder value, you know, create value, you know, expand, grow, meet demands in the marketplace, et cetera. So I liked what you said about thinking long-term and maybe being responsive to the interests of other groups. But can this coexist with the goal or the drive towards greater profitability or, you know, expanding and creating value with the other things we're talking about here? It sounds like they can coexist, David. Am I right?
Boy, you're exactly right. And you're in the middle of what used to be an interesting debate, but I don't believe is even a debate anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Milton Friedman idea that the sole purpose of the corporation is to maximize short-term profits is really, I don't want to pronounce its death, but it's on the ropes, if nothing else. And you have both corporations embracing the idea that the long term matters, that the constituencies are broader than simply the shareholders, mm-hmm. which quite frankly is a relatively novel thing today. And go back in history, it maybe was considered more. But the an example of this is the Business Roundtable's recent statement of purpose. Mm-hmm. It placed shareholders as one of five stakeholders alongside customers and workers and suppliers and communities, mm-hmm. and said that the board and the company needs to consider, you know, all of these various interest groups. You know, sure. In England, there's an academic who's kind of looking at the purpose of the corporation as part of a larger project. And you know, he noted this with this language I found relevant to what you just asked, David. It says the purpose of the company is to, quote, produce solutions to problems of people and planet, mm-hmm. and in the process, produce profits. Mm-hmm. My own view is that this is a fairly revolutionary change in how we're thinking about what the purpose of the company is. Right. And that will have, the hope is, it will have long-term beneficial effects for shareholders, investors, and the community. I, you know, obviously it will remain to be seen what happens, but the purpose is this is designed to fit within a system where the company does make money and is successful, but maybe measuring that success in a way that's different than it used to.
I'm encouraged hearing that, and that's certainly enlightened and progressive, and I think certainly that's the way the global attitude appears to be going, so this is welcome news. Let's go back to Linda for a second. Let's talk about disclosures. What is and what isn't required in some of the jurisdictions with which you're familiar in terms of disclosures with, you know, ESG?
Sure. I practice in France, obviously a member of the EU. Mm-hmm. And just to follow up on what David said about taking into account stakeholders' interests other than or in addition to shareholders, that's actually been a basis in company law here in Europe and in particular in France for a very long time. So these ideas are not new, that there are lots of stakeholders around the table, mm-hmm. not just the shareholders, and that corporate boards and management need to consider all of those interests as they're making decisions about what's best for the corporation. And that's been reflected in obligations to make disclosures in Europe and in France also, you know, in France more particularly. Since really the 2000, so the turn of the millennium, the UK started requiring disclosures by certain market actors covering ESG matters. Huh? France followed up quickly in 2001. And things have been accelerating since then. I think there's several data points where we see that disclosure obligations in terms of ESG have been accelerating here in Europe generally. So the most recent one that's making quite a bit of waves here is the directive adopted in 2014, mm-hmm. that requires entities to make all sorts of entities. David mentioned some of the actors that are around the table. So companies, investment advisors, mm-hmm. Institutional investors all have to start disclosing very specific things about ESG matters. And recently there's what we call the taxonomy that was published, which is really an attempt to take a scientific approach to weighing a specific entity's ESG component so okay. that there can be a kind of almost quantifiable, not just qualifiable, quantitative rather than mm-hmm. qualitative or solely qualitative criteria that can be used. So the taxonomy is still being developed, but it's something that all of the market actors are going to have to take into account.
I liked what you said about this being not subjective. Maybe it's qualitative all of a sudden, and there might be data points or metrics or so forth. That's encouraging, I think, that someone's figured out a way to actually measure this. Because, you know, if you can't measure something, you can't improve it, correct? So it sounds like the trend is solidly in place for this globally, would you say, Linda?
I think so. The infrastructure is being put into place now. I think we've all been, there's been this desire or this movement to have sustainability addressed. And I think now we're working on the infrastructure. How do you decide whether a portfolio is green or not green? The sustainable or not sustainable? What percentage of a company is or should be considered in the sustainable bucket, and what part of it should be considered out of the sustainable bucket, so that when you put an investment portfolio together, you can actually reflect or have some idea that you've reflected in a rigorous and systematic way, something that until now has been very aspirational and a little fluffy.
Yeah. I'm just going to ask this because I think people are probably wondering as they're listening, where are United States companies with this? Are U.S. concerns lagging? Are they behind Europe? Are they catching on? Is there a real movement here? Or how would you characterize the U.S. view of all this right now, Linda?
I think the U.S. is certainly catching up. And you know, one of the things that is important to remember is that in the U.S., the liability, and David will talk about this a little bit more, but the liability for disclosure can bite hard.
Yeah.
In Europe, the bite is less dramatic. I think the regulations are pushing all of the market actors into making these disclosures, and they're going to be very important. They're going to be overseen by the regulators, but there's not the litigation in Europe component mm-hmm. that is very present in the United States.
Okay, well, let's go to David and pick up on that point. And Linda brings up disclosures. Disclosures will carry certain risks. David, can you run down some of those for us?
Sure. There's a couple of, I would say, high-level risks, and we can talk about later how you deal with these risks, but these are big 30,000-foot level type risks that you are going to have as you get deeper and deeper into ESG disclosures. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, the most immediate risk is to not do anything, the risk of not doing anything. You know, there's a tremendous amount of pressure, as we've discussed, both from shareholders, investors, and from the public to disclose around this. And I think at this point, it is probably not possible for most public companies to avoid at least thinking about this and deciding kind of what risks are material to them, what ESG-related risks are material to them, and how are they going to go about, you know, satisfying that demand for more disclosure. So
the first
is the risk of not doing anything. You know, the second is developing unreasonable expectations after you've disclosed those ESG risks and after you've disclosed more about your ESG activities. You know, this is not a marketing exercise. It is an exercise where companies are sort of looking to their long-term exposure, their long-term operating platform, and they're deciding what is material, what is going to help them perform better. And so I think part of this is, you know, you don't want to develop unreasonable expectations about how you're going to comply with something sort of like a zero emissions operation or something, you know, without thinking about exactly how that's going to be done. The simplest risk is the same risk you would have with respect to any disclosure, and that is saying things that turn out to have sounded good but are inaccurate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the simple risk of you need to say what you do, and then you need to do what you say. And when you don't do that, as Linda mentioned, in the U.S., you could subject yourself to the risk of government investigations and litigation arising from those ESG statements, largely without regard to where they're made, whether they're made on your website, whether they're made in SEC filings.
Right.
I think as investors start to view these and as companies start to view these types of disclosures as material, that the need for accuracy in them becomes even more important. And, you know, I wanted to, if you don't mind, go back real briefly to the question you asked about, does this sacrifice profits?
Yeah.
There is a growing belief among investors that companies with a strong commitment to ESG issues are going to perform better in the long term than those that aren't so focused. And I think this is becoming a more nuanced statement in that it isn't just companies that talk about general ESG mm-hmm. issues,
yes.
but it's companies that address ESG issues that are material to their business. And those companies, there is a belief, are going to outperform companies who aren't considering those kind of broader plate of issues. I think that goes to the point I just made about materiality as well, which is, you know, companies here are looking at those ESG issues that are material to their business, not just some general plate of issues that might affect everyone.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, clearly the ESG issues for a mining company in South America are different than they are for a, you know, a law firm based in London, right? I mean, everybody's ESG is different.
That's exactly right. And the real trick is getting the people in the company who know, the technical side, the board, those in leadership, to really analyze the company's business to understand, you know, what are the material risks around these ESG disclosures. There are a number of, I would say, third parties who are trying to assist companies in that process and coming up with a materiality matrix, for instance. And I think those are helpful for companies thinking about, what are we disclosing? And are we an extractive industry where climate change is going to be a big issue?
Yeah.
Or are we a retail industry that maybe needs to focus more on our supply chain, for instance? Sure. And those are the kinds of thinking I think that companies are going to be going through, and frankly, that investors are going to be going through as they think about what to invest in.
You know, the other thing that occurs to me hearing you talk, and I probably shouldn't use this term because I've heard it in other contexts where it's more, but there's probably some reputational risk here too, isn't there? I mean, this company is slow to the ESG game, or God forbid, this company has misstated things in terms of what it's doing. I'd imagine this is being taken very seriously in boardrooms and at shareholder meetings and anywhere else where these decisions are made. Am I right?
That is a fantastic point. It goes to some of these other risks, not doing anything, not doing what you actually say you're doing. But let me just put a point on that. Sure. I think your question is exactly right. And where those risks today are different than they were even 10 years ago is these issues are really, really important to millennials. Mm-hmm. And millennials use social media a lot. And there are too many examples to discuss about how a company's performance on some issue that matters was trashed through social media.
Yeah.
And I think the reputational issues are heightened, whether social media actually represents a majority or even a small minority of the population is almost irrelevant at this point, because social media has the ability to blow up even small missteps.
Sure.
And around these ESG issues, which are of greater concern, frankly, to millennials than they are to those of us who are not millennials, that is a particular place where your reputational risk is quite elevated.
That's interesting. I hadn't even thought about this in a generational context, but you're right. I mean, that ship has clearly arrived, right? So this escalates this to a greater level of importance than I even thought. Well, all right, we spent some time talking about risk. Let's talk about how we manage those or mitigate those. Linda, in terms of some of the things David's brought up, what can an organization do to make sure that it is managing these types of risks as best as it can? What would you recommend?
Well, you know, I think that we're at a point in time that was similar to the beginning of the 2000s, right after Sarbanes-Oxley, where companies were putting in place internal controls over financial reporting. And I think they should be looking at much of these questions with the same level of rigor that they used in their internal controls to make sure that they have a process to identify what the risks are, what the subject matters are, what their disclosure is, and what it should be going forward, and to make sure that they have actual processes in place that they can point to and that they can test over time to make sure that their disclosures are accurate over time, and that if they need to be evolving, that they can be evolving in a smart and gradual way. I think the important thing to remember is that people are putting real money behind these decisions, so they are going to be paying attention to these disclosures in the same way that they do with financial information. I think you need to make sure that you've got the right specialists, similar to having your accountants, that you have the right specialists looking at your information so that it's not easily manipulable or easily disproved fluff. We have environmental experts here, for example, who look at and challenge disclosure when there's disclosure being made about things that are related to environmental law. There are third-party experts. There are also some, you know, rating agencies and others who are making actually business cases about going in and auditing what until now or until recently hasn't been considered really auditable. So, for example, things like auditing your supply chain. Yeah. You know, we've seen it also coming out of some of the sanctions work, where you make sure that you do your due diligence on who are your intermediaries, making sure that you're not contracting with people that have the risk attached of actually hurting your reputation because they aren't going to be following your policies.
Sure, sure. I wonder, and this does happen, contrary to what a lot of people believe, but competitors do cooperate on certain things, you know, an emerging issue type thing. There is sharing information, and I don't mean in some nefarious way. We're not talking about price fixing or anything weird like that. But I've noticed historically when a movement is afoot like this, you know, there's a lot of chatter at industry conferences, at meetings, at trade shows, professional organizations. I think sharing information and understanding where your peers are going with this and what, I'll use the term, best practices might be, I think that can be a tremendous help when you're venturing into new territory like this. Would you agree, Linda?
I definitely agree. And I think actually that's a good point. I mean, one of the things that, about this whole area, we've been focusing on risks, for example, but there's actually lots and lots of positive energy and positive movements, positive evolutions that are coming out of this. So I think there is actually a great opportunity for people to be sharing information, sharing best practices. Sure. The taxonomy, for example, here in Europe has generated a lot of discussion on whether the approach makes sense, whether there might be a better approach, how companies and portfolio managers can actually be using these criteria to actually work, you know, change their business, actually make their business better. Sure. And I think those are the things that are exciting out of this movement.
Good enough. All right. Hey, this has been terrific. Let's wrap it up with this, with maybe some practical tips or pointers, because that's what we do at Jones Day Talks. We don't just pontificate. We provide our audience with useful information. What can companies do to prepare right now? This movement, it's apparent just from our conversation. This isn't going anywhere. This is a positive thing, and it's coming. In places where it hasn't already arrived, it's certainly coming. Let's go to David first. What should an organization do right now to start preparing for ESG-type disclosures?
So I'm going to give you three thoughts very quick, and they'll start from the high level and they'll go down to the more granular level. Mm-hmm. I would say the first thing that companies need to be doing is to involve the board to clearly articulate their strategy behind these ESG issues. I heard it put that managing the risks that we've been discussing in this relating to ESG begins with the G in ESG. That is governance. Okay. And I think that's, so having the board involved in this, understanding what the goals are and helping to set the agenda and overseeing it is very, very important. The second thing I would say is the companies who are already disclosing or deciding what to disclose should figure out how they are going to measure success internally before they discuss things externally. And to the extent that isn't set or the technology isn't there to measure it as well as they'd like, they need to say that. They need to be open about how they're going to measure success. Mm-hmm. And then the last thing I would say is in deciding what to disclose, rather than sort of take a grab bag approach, I think they need to use cross-functional teams to see the disclosures, to see the company's business from all angles, and decide which ESG issues are material to the company, and then focus on those. Focus on those from a disclosure standpoint, a measurement standpoint, and an operational standpoint, and make that meaningful, because that's how sophisticated investors are going to be looking at these issues, and I think it's how the company should look at them as well.
Great insight, really powerful stuff. Linda, what would you add?
I would just add that these rules and these subjects are actually impacting all areas of our business and our clients' business. So, for example, the financial services, the asset managers, the banks, they all need to be looking at these issues as well. I think the first thing is to make sure that, as David said, you know, these are board level issues, no matter what industry you're in, including financial services. But for the financial services area, it's also a big compliance point, because these are regulatory requirements that they are going to have to be able to comply with. They're going to have systems in place. It needs to be audited in case they have an examiner who's coming to see them. So I think the important idea is to make sure that the board and the compliance departments are fully engaged on these.
Sounds great. I think you nailed it, Linda. You nailed it. Hey, let's leave this right there. This has been so informative. I learned a lot today. And this is just going to get bigger, I think. If you'd like to, why don't we round up early next year, talk again. There'll be some progress and some changes, certainly. So if you'd like to come back early 2020, let's talk about where we are at that point, if that'd be good with you too.
That sounds great.
Awesome.
Yeah, definitely.
Thanks, Linda, David, thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks.
Have a great day.
Thanks to you both. Bye-bye.
Bye now. For complete bios and contact information for Linda Hess and David Woodcock, visit jonesday.com. While you're there, check out our insights page for more podcasts, publications, videos, newsletters, and other valuable information. Subscribe to Jones Day Talks on Apple Podcasts and wherever else podcasts are available. As always, we thank you for listening. I'm Dave Dalton. We'll talk to you next time.
Thank you for listening to Jones Day Talks. Comments heard on Jones Day Talks should not be construed as legal advice regarding any specific facts or circumstances. The opinions expressed on Jones Day Talks are those of lawyers appearing on the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the firm. For more information, please visit jonesday.com.